Excellent. So thank you, Steve. Lorenzo Volpi, Deputy CEO of Ledenor Capital Partners. I was asked by Steve not to give a full introduction of our guest because you all have the program and you can find the bios of our guest there. But so very quickly, I'm very pleased to introduce Evelyn from PGGM, Michael from LGT,
morning,
Bernard from Hoop, and Jason from Gallagher Re. So before I ask, I go into the questions with our guest, maybe I'll just make three quick comments following what Steve just said. So the combination of the elevated premiums, but also the strong collateral return, which I think is a very important topic because we want to see what will happen in terms of investor sentiment when we start seeing interest rates starting going down, hopefully, in the near future, led to fantastic returns in 2023. It was the best year ever for investors in terms of the returns that we made, but not only for our asset class, but we basically outperformed most of the alternative asset classes, which is obviously very relevant when we want to increase the awareness for the ability for investors to access ILS. Now, this occurred despite the losses that we had in 2023. In 2023, the estimated industry losses were about 120, 125 billion, and this came from a number of events, the bulk of it from convective storms in the US, which was slightly higher than 50 billion. Then we had floods in New Zealand, Hurricane Otis in Mexico, the earthquake in Turkey, to mention a few. Now, it's clear that now 100 billion industry losses per annum seems to be the new normal. But it's also clear that most of the ILS managers have learned some lessons. And one of the biggest tasks for us has been how we demonstrate to investors that we've learned from the past. At the same time, we also recognize that most of these insurance losses have been retained by the insurers. So the outcome of the reinsurance companies has been very profitable, but not very much so for the insurance companies, which means that their profitability has been under pressure, but also their need for reinsurance continue to increase. The good news is that the higher demand of reinsurance has been met with a record level of alternative capital that has been over, again, these are all estimates, but it's around $100 billion. And as Steve mentioned earlier, we also witnessed a record of issuance of cat bonds with 11 new sponsors plus a number of returning sponsors to the market. So having said that, maybe if we start with Evelyn, in terms of investor sentiment, obviously you've been investing in this sector now for many years. You're probably the biggest investor out there. So how has the sentiment evolved at your firm, not just within your team maybe, but also within the investment committee when you had to present the opportunity?
Yeah, well, I think we're in a much better place than we were a couple of years ago. So that's good. 2023 is a good year. 2022 was not great, but from a diversification perspective, which is one of the reasons why we invest in ILS, was still decent. So that's good. Going forward, I think rates are great. Retentions are really at the place where they need to be. So that's good. And in addition to that, as you already mentioned yourself, there were definitely lessons learned. So I think also risk has kind of recalibrated over the last couple of years. So from a risk-adjusted perspective, I think it's we're actually in a place where we would like to be.
Thank you. Bernard, what is your view on that?
Well, I would echo what Evelyn has said. 2023 was a good year, which we really needed as an industry. The fund that I work for has been in ILS for 4 years, and I think the investment committee the board are through still sort of going through that education process of getting comfortable with ILS and reinsurance as a space. And so we've had some difficult years, but we now have marked a very good year. But it's not enough to really cement that conviction. I think it's going to require, you know, longer term. We can't see rates and terms and conditions sort of plateau and then come down very quickly. We need to maintain discipline going forward. And remember, this is a long-term play. We're going to be in this market for many years, but we'll scale up and down according to where pricing and a whole host of factors are. So 1 year doesn't make a great asset class. We need a continued sort of dynamic that is similar to 2023.
Thanks. And Michael, obviously you talked to various investors around the world. So what is your the feedback that you can share?
So I think from our end, we have seen a cycle, as we all know. And I think what defines a cycle is a lag. And on the investor side, what we have experienced is a group of investors that have allocated to the strategy for years and have started to retreat after we have seen an increase in loss activity. And of course, climate change is always a topic that you need to discuss with investors, but it's down to results. And we have seen results being under pressure. For European ILS managers and European investors, additionally, there was this challenge of the FX exposure. So if you hedge a dollar stream of returns into euros or Swiss francs, you will lose another 300 basis points in the worst years, worst in terms of rate differential. And if you then only generate low single-digit levels of return after losses, so if you still have a bit of a loss, but you're still positive, and then you eat away another 300 basis points, we also need to live. So there is a bit of a management fee attached to that, and then there is not much left. And so certain investors have started to retreat. Now, 2023 was a great year, as we all know, but we also all understand there have been special effects on that year, including some recoveries and some spread tightening in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian. Also, the much higher collateral return helps, of course. And so your question on how do I gauge and how do we see investor interest, it's coming back. And I unfortunately almost fear that it's coming back hard. And I guess we're in close discussions with the teams from the securities groups to manage flows. Because if I look back the last 15 years I've been doing ILS, I guess the key challenge for the market and for ILS managers is managing interests, managing investor interest and managing deal flow to get to an optimal level. And so there's been a lag, and 2023 has been great, but of course it has been great because there was a lack of capital. And I guess time will tell now for the next months to come whether investor interest will return and whether deal flow will match. I guess that's then a good...
And what about you, Jason? Obviously, you have a different perspective, given that at Gallagher Re, you're very active in the cab bonds and sidecars.
Yeah, so from our perspective, from the perspective of the ILS funds we talked to, 2023 was obviously a stellar year. As you look at forward inflows, it does seem like there's generally, as we talk to ILS investors, there's money coming in. However, I don't think it's the same velocity that it has been in the past. Generally, it's still harder to raise capital for collateralized re mandates than it is for the more liquid cat bond funds. But we are seeing some have success in that arena as well. We've heard from one or two ILS funds that have said they have some opportunistic investors that came in last year that are taking some money off the table in 2024. I don't think that's a broad across the board sentiment, but there are, for those investors, it's sort of matched inflows and outflows. I think generally from the end investors, there's still a concern, the typical concerns over climate change and modeling risk, but to some extent, those are alleviated a little bit with just how far rates have gone up over the last several years. So I think generally among the ILS funds, sentiment's pretty positive at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Bernard, you made a good point in terms of the sustainability of the market, right? I mean, we all know that. So last year, we were all discussing, let's hope we have a good year next year. because investors, you know, we keep saying about premiums increasing year on year. We keep saying about terms and conditions getting tighter and more favorable. However, investors really want to see that in the ultimate performance. So now we had a stellar year. However, we know how the market works now. We could argue that the market is totally restructured. So the big difference maybe between now and post-Andrew or post-Katrina Ritten-Wilma is that premiums have readjusted across the board because insurance companies want to be profitable on the liability side and not just invest their premiums to make money on the asset side, which was the old model in a way. However, we know that maybe in the next renewal, hopefully not, it would be, the pressure won't be so high, but we'll have to give up something, right? So what do you think when we start negotiating, where would you be more flexible in letting it go, let's say?
My short answer would be don't be flexible. Too flexible. But, what I'm thinking about is, there are a number of factors that play into this, I think. I've been in markets since, late 2005, so I've seen the aftermath of that year. And the investor base, I think everybody, in the space has gotten more sophisticated. I think the investor base has gotten more comfortable and more knowledgeable about the asset class. And so some of us have gone through that long cycle and are maybe a little bit wiser about the capabilities of models of ourselves collectively to evaluate risk and price risk. So I think that plays into it. We've been there before. We've seen the ups and the downs. We know what's coming next, right? And so let's try not to repeat maybe the same mistakes we went through last year. And then you've got climate change, which is a significant concern across the board on the end investor side. And you have to question, also another factor that you have to consider is also the evolution of the modeling technology, the modeling vendors, et cetera, how they've evolved their platforms, how much, have the risk models really improved significantly? Are they lagging? Do they look at physical climate change in an intelligent way? There are many areas to work on, I think, to make sure this asset class continues to be really attractive.
Okay. Evelyn, what's your view?
My view is that that question comes a little bit too soon, too early. As Bernard mentioned, 1 year of great results is not good enough to overcome the 7 years before. So that's the first thing. Over time, this is also not sustainable. And as we are reinsurer, insurer, we're all in this together. So there should be something to converge to that's reasonable for everyone, given the uncertainty in the world, given climate change, all true. If you ask which element I would prefer to stick to, that's definitely structure. So going back to lowering retentions, given the amount of inflation that we've seen, I think we should not go there. I find it difficult to comment on terms and conditions from an end investor perspective. That's less visible to us. So we see rates, clearly we see risk profiles. So maybe Michael is able to comment on that more on terms and conditions. So ultimately that leaves us with rate, where I do think over time that will trend.
Loud and clear. So Michael, then.
Well, ultimately the question is about cycle management, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do we manage the cycle? Yeah. My former boss at Swiss Re once said, cycle management is an HR issue. It's not a technical question. Now, on our end, for us, the answer is really very simple. And it sounds very oversimplified answer, but I truthfully mean it, and then probably have to play it back to Evelyn. So what we do is we've been given a mandate to allocate money. The money will be put to work for the best terms and the best conditions. And then we report back to our investors what's happening in our market. Our investors will then have to take a decision, is that market still worthwhile allocating to? Is the amount that I'm allocating in this market yielding the level of return that I want to see? Very much also compared to other opportunities. We have to be mindful companies that allocate into ILS, the allocation to ILS is minimal, is anywhere between, in Switzerland it would typically be 2-3, max 4%. And 95, 96, 97% is allocated to other asset classes that are also having an outlook, that also show an opportunity of generating a return. So my mandate is I put the money to work and I report back where we see pricing, where we see the multiple, where we see also soft, of course, elements around the allocation, terms and conditions, and then leave it to our investors to take the ultimate decision. I know it sounds oversimplified, but I feel that transparency is the best answer that I can give as an ILS manager.
So I think we are, the four of us are strongly aligned to make sure that this sector remains profitable over the long term before Jason calls us up and tries to squeeze us. So Jason, your angle, where you're going to start trying squeezing us.
I do think the market has peaked. And we're, beginning our descent, but I don't see a terms and condition degrading that quickly. Okay. But I do think that will happen over time. How long, to be determined. But I do think that will happen as we go through the cycle.
Well, and then I think we just need to, as end investors, take our responsibility and also reduce capital if we don't believe that the market is adequate. And I think also that will likely happen because we also learned from the past. And even though you do compare it to other asset classes, it still has a big opportunity of a huge drawdown and capital will be gone. And I think that's also something to take into consideration.
Maybe one additional comment here, just as you mentioned, what we also see is it's the responsibility of the end investor to find a suitable remuneration structure for the ILS manager. Because if the ILS manager, and of course, trying to pitch a bit our approach, we're working for a flat management fee. We consider ourselves to be a portfolio manager. We allocate the money and we put it to work and we work for a flat fee to compensate us for the work that we do. We don't charge performance fees. Because if you charge performance fees in our trade, of course, then there is the question on what is your ultimate goal as an ILS manager. If you're paid on performance fees, you're also trying to optimize performance, maybe not necessarily to the benefit of the investor, not necessarily managing risk in the appropriate way. And so it's, again, back to the end investor to manage the allocation and make sure that ILS managers are compensated in a proper alignment of interest.
Yeah, and we are, I'm in your camp, we don't pay performance fees, so I think we consider this market still a beta. I think that's very...
It hurts a bit.
Yes, I know. It's not that we don't appreciate good underwriting and good risk selection. However, it's so dependent on whether there's an event or not that I don't think that warrants a performance fee.
I think the beauty is that there is flexibility, right? I mean, in terms of what managers can offer between management fees, performance fees, and ultimately we all listen to the clients because there are some clients that maybe prefer actually to pay more performance fee and less management fees just to be more aligned with the manager. But, that's obviously we are flexible. Now, we know that there are many ways to assess this asset class, right, in terms of the instruments. So we talk about the cap bonds, we talk about proper placements, whether it's through quota shares, excess of loss type of contracts, and so on. So, Bernard, in terms of your approach to the asset class, how has that evolved in terms of your appetite?
I think it's been fairly stable over the years. So, I've been in ILS since 2005 for a number of firms, and it's institutional firms, and I think it's always been fairly stable. And I think it's no secret we manage our own internal cat bond book, and then allocate to fund managers and participate in sidecars. So there is definitely a little bit of adjustment that's being made from year to year on the relative weights of those three items, but we essentially play across the board in terms of insurance, reinsurance, retro, perils, etc. So we've got a fairly broad mandate. One item that I wanted to kind of add to the previous question, or this is relevant to this too, you know, I think the discussions are often very simplistic, you know, when I read it on online or in a publication about, you know, are investors coming in, or are they, has their appetite to the asset class increased? I think you have to remember that ILS, as Michael said, the allocation of a pension fund to ILS might be, you know, anywhere between 1% and 3%. That's not a lot. And especially when there are much more important dynamics going around in the world, ILS is really at the bottom of the to-do list, right? In terms of the investment or allocation committee. And so in our case, you know, I think we differ from some other investors in that we are involved in the markets directly on the cat bond side. And so we do have ways of managing our exposure sort of intra-year. But to the broader investment community that's looking at all strategies within the fund, ILS usually doesn't even enter the discussion, right? So again, it goes back to
this. Is this because you're not very active? It's just the size.
It's just the size.
How scalable it is.
It's not going to, it will never be much bigger than, you know, let's say 2%. Okay. And so keep that in mind. ILS is not very scalable and it's not very liquid relative to other strategies, and that's a hindrance.
So is there an angle there where maybe you could look at the different type of perils? So for example, later we have a session on cyber,
we've got a pretty broad mandate, so we're looking at all the perils out there that share the same characteristics as property cat. You know, low correlation to other strategies and asset classes, credible and strong ability to quantify the risk and pricing environment, et cetera. So.
Okay, well, probably the panel will discuss that later.
But sure, you mentioned
diversification or low correlation and ability to quantify the risk that doesn't really apply maybe to some of those specialty risk where we're trying to expand.
At the same time, you do have to educate yourself on new emerging risks and sort of participate in the development of that pocket of risk, really, okay. I think.
Thank you. Yeah, sorry, Mike.
If I may, just one additional comment. This was a very interesting comment. What we see in Europe at times, we now have investors here on the panel with subject matter experts as part of the investment team. Many investors do not have that. Many investors are broader pension plans. Again, small teams allocating a variety of asset classes. What we have seen in Europe, and that's really just recent feedback that I've received, is certain pension funds have started to exit ILS for a very special reason. 2023 was a good year, yes. We have to be mindful. Some of the life structures have seen a bit of an impairment. So overall, there were some events that did impact some of the allocations. And so some pension funds exited the asset class because it became too complicated. If I say too complicated, you have to report back to a board of trustees and you have to explain to them what you do. And if you have to go back over and over and over again to Bernard's point, for a small allocation, it's at one point just too painful. And you also do not want to defend the allocation. You don't want to be the one party in the group of investment committees or the members that say, oh, we should do ILS, because you know there's a certain career risk attached to it. If something goes wrong, people will say, that was your pitch, you wanted it. So we've experienced now two concrete cases in Switzerland where large pension schemes decided to exit ILS for that reason, because the responsible person, not a subject matter expert, did not want to continue justifying the asset class, even though he personally then said, I love it and the outlook is great, but I've had it. And so that's a bit of a challenge. This allocation is so small, it's such a niche, it's a complicated sort of, I would say.
Yeah, I hear your comments. I think that we have a duty as investors to make sure that we consolidate these returns and we prove that over the long term we can be profitable by dealing with risk that we understand and they understand, rather than keep teaching them new lessons that might actually play against us in the future. But of course, again, at the same time, we're all very much in favor of the development of the market. So, you know, there are, the good news is there are always investors with different appetite up there, you know, out there that will find reasons to do different things. But there are, you know, more conservative investors and other type of investors. Now, Evelyn, in terms of your allocation, again, you have, you know, been investing for a long time. You have done a lot of different things. So is there something new that you want to add? Are you just looking at consolidating what you have?
Well, I think we all know we're property cat only, also for a reason that we speak to our board. So we have been investing since 2006, so very dedicated to the asset class. We spent quite some time educating both internal as well as external stakeholders, making sure that also our board does understand what we do. So when it comes to other risks, they feel less comfortable. So that's where we do not get enough traction with them. So they, for now, we continue to stick to property cat. And when it comes to our risk profile, I think that's very well defined. They all agree to that. I think we have a slightly moderate risk profile, so maybe we did not suffer maybe as much as some others did. There were some. That's what you see with ILS. There's so many different investors that some have very strong risk appetite. So if they faced severe drawdowns in 2017-18, we were not part of that. So we were able to still manage that internally. Okay. And that is helpful.
Jason, so at Gallagher, you guys have built quite a sizable team in the capital markets area, and obviously you are in charge of the distribution. Now, what are your goals? I mean, what would you love to achieve in terms of augmenting the penetration or bringing new products to the market?
Well, I look at what's the thesis of ILS. It's really like you look back at when ILS started after Hurricane Andrew. It's really like where's the capital was really needed for cat reinsurance, right? And I look at where in the market is that need now. And I would point to cyber. And I know everybody has different views, and there's a whole panel on it. So I would look at cyber as that could be a growth engine for our market going forward. I think there's a tremendous need there. There could be, you know, everybody expects that market to grow quite a bit over the course of the next decade or whatever. So I think it's going to need capital markets participation. The way investors are currently participating, it's into more of the commingled funds with NatCat. I think that somewhat limits cyber to maybe 5 to 10% of the assets in this space, but I think the need is a lot bigger than that. So that's still a lot of runway for deals, but I think the need is bigger than that. So I think you need to see new investors in the space, and then investors setting up funds, whether it's just invest in specialty lines, et cetera. So okay. I think going forward, that could be a big opportunity for our sector.
So you mentioned new investors in the space. I think the big difference, and obviously I'm interested to hear your view, Michael, you know, the big difference between today and post 17 is that, you know, post 17 we used to call it the year of the great reload, right? I mean, we had so much money coming in. We all had to close our funds at one point, try to show that we were disciplined and, you know, this. Today is probably a different market, right? So we see interest, but how much interest? I mean, also from a geographical standpoint, how have you seen the interest evolving?
On our end, the last point is an interesting one. We have seen, as a Swiss investment manager, of course, we started out in Switzerland 15, 20 years ago and raised a lot of money in Switzerland. And there's also some cyclicality to investor interest on a geographical scale, and that's an interesting comment that you just made. So we are clearly seeing the sort of developed markets, if you will, developed in terms of markets that have allocated for a long time in this space, to take a bit of a sidestep, to take a bit, maybe take, you know, some money from the table, maybe take a bit of a more cautious approach. I've mentioned the two cases, the very recent cases, where it just became a bit too complicated to just, and people were starting to retreat. We now see a increased interest in, I wouldn't call it developing markets, is of course the very wrong term, but you see my point, in markets that have in the past not really allocated a lot of money into this space. And as an interesting point, we see a lot of new interest in markets where you believe they have already allocated and the market is sort of set, and that's Canada, for instance. I just traveled to Canada last week and met with a couple of investors who either have allocated or are currently looking at the space, and the interest is really tangible. It's you can feel it. And another market is Australia, where again you would feel that, well, Australia, we've heard about Australia for years and it's probably a saturated market. Well, apparently it's not. And there is a lot more money coming into the space in markets like Australia. And so we're seeing a revived interest in markets where you believe, well, they've had it and they should be saturated. But we see a declining interest in markets such as, again, Switzerland is an overwhelming market where we clearly see a declined interest. And people don't even want to talk about ILS anymore. You call them up and say, can we talk about ILS? They say, no. And you can tell it takes a bit of time for the sort of the committee composition to change and for sort of younger people to come in again or different people to come in again to start to have a fresh look, because once you've allocated to a certain space and you decided to exit, you cannot re-enter for the next 3 to 5 years. It's just because of the documentation that you've entered and submitted and the reason that you gave why you should exit, there has to be a fundamental shift and change, and we're not necessarily seeing this. There's a bit of cyclicality. So that is a challenge that we see. And then just on capacity, as I mentioned, I guess the biggest challenge, and I'm sure you support that statement, Lorenzo, the biggest challenge for an ILS manager is managing capacity. You mentioned that after 2017, we have seen a lot of interest. We're now seeing a lot of interest again. We're dealing differently this time around with the interest. I think our entire organization has gone through a fundamental learning process on how you have to manage capacity at a company level, also within the sales team. We're working with fixed capacity levels. So we know exactly how much money we intend to take on for this year, because that's the type of money we, all else being equal, and of course, Jason, I hope you tell me a lot about the overwhelming pipeline. We see many, many deals, but right now, we are expecting healthy pipeline, we are expecting new deals, but we also manage capacity. And then the interesting bit is, and goes back a bit to pricing, and that means that we don't have to compete on price, because we don't want and don't need to grow at any sort of cost. We know exactly how much we can deploy within our structures, within our sort of allocation strategy, and there is a glass ceiling to how big we can be. And that's, in my view, surprisingly low, that glass ceiling, because we still want to be selective, we still want to do the deals that we should be doing, want to be doing, and at one point we'll just close down and go golfing, maybe.
Interesting. So, Evelyn, how do you manage capacity? Before you made a comment about, well, be careful out there, because if premiums go down, then we pull it. So, yeah. Is it about relative value versus other asset classes? How do you look at it?
So, in principle, we have a strategic allocation, but we were trying to convince our strategy department to, there's always a bandwidth around that, to have a much wider bandwidth than we currently have. So we can be larger in times when rates are up and smaller in times when rates are down. Yes, I strongly believe that there was way too much capital prior to 2017 in the system, and clearly we were part of that. So if we can manage that going forward in a better and more efficient way, we'll do so.
And the Bernard?
I think I echo the same sentiments. I think the way I look at it, we have a particular, maximum allocation to ILS. I'd like to stay below that, such that when I see, really good opportunities, I don't have to go through a lot of sort of approvals to act quickly. I think that's okay. So it's fairly, with an allocation to cat bonds and allocation to the other stuff, I think it's fairly makes it fairly easy to manage that capacity and take some money off the table when necessary.
And to Michael's point about the pipeline, it does seem like the pipeline is pretty healthy and robust. And we have, speaking from, I don't know everyone's pipeline, obviously, but from our pipeline, is relatively full. And from what I hear in the market, there could be several deals that are looking for significant amounts of capacity. So I think that's all helpful with that. Right now, we're in a situation where there is a lot of money flowing around in the cap bond space just from maturities, coupons, end of year flows. So you have a situation where prices are getting bid up and spreads down. Just everybody's kind of waiting for that pipeline to really, really ramp up, which I think it we're in the process of doing now.
And what about your feeling in terms of interest from ultimate investors? So obviously you spend most of your time, pitching us as ILS managers, for your products. But I assume there is also an element of learning or teaching to a wider community of investors that are just learning about it. Are you experiencing any interest in terms of ability to penetrate new investors, which came up three times earlier in terms of more money?
I think that was easier to do in the past, to be honest with you. Almost everyone's heard of ILS now. If you go back when we were on the same team back in the day, there was fertile ground. You could go into a pension, they've never heard of ILS, and you could teach them, et cetera, like you're saying. But I think now people have preconceived notions about the asset class, because almost everybody you go into has at least had somebody's been in there pitching, or they've heard about the asset class. And I think it's helpful that we're, that you see us in the ILS is in the Financial Times and Wall Street Journal, and I think that helps educate folks as well that maybe don't hear about the space as much.
Okay. I would have an additional question there to Jason. So what I've heard now, talking to a couple of your peers, is that there's an interesting development, also new in interest, direct interest from fixed income managers that to buy cap bonds directly,
yes,
to not even go down the path. I don't understand why, but don't even use ILS managers. So can you maybe elaborate on that?
Yes, and there's always been an element of that, right? And those will come in and out. I think we're in a situation now where spreads are, it makes sense to kind of educate yourself if you're a fixed income buyer. You kind of have some comfort in the fact that it's a syndicated product. So there's safety in numbers. So when you know that folks like Michael Stahel and Lorenzo Volpi are looking at the cap bond, and you participate with a small bet, you have some comfort there. So you do see more investors coming into the space, and I think that'll continue if rates stay where they are.
Actually, on that note, in terms of where we are with regard to pricing, right? So we obviously started 2023 with a dislocated market where the average coupon for cat bonds were the highest ever, back to the same levels post-Katrina, Rita, and Wilma. And the same was for for private placements, right? Now we've seen probably more money in 2023 chasing the liquid alternative space, so the cat bonds, with spreads that compressed. Now spreads are still very attractive. Again, I don't want to steal, the talk later, but they're still attractive on a relative basis. However, we are starting to see the decoupling of pricing between private placements and cap bonds. So maybe, Evelyn, in terms of your asset allocation, does it mean that you're going to maybe scale back from cap bonds and increase a bit private placements, or you have a different take on that?
I think no is the answer. So in principle, we're instrument agnostic. So we invest in cat bonds, collateralized reinsurance, in sidecars. We back a rated entity. I think it's, in principle, we try to be strategic to our partners. And yes, we do shift some capital if we see a large dislocation, but if it's in small amounts, it's too large of an allocation. It's 8 billion. You cannot wiggle that around easily. So no, we don't.
And Bernard?
I don't know if I have much more to add. I would say I would welcome more end investors actually getting closer to the risk and directly accessing the cat bond market. I think it would be healthy for the market, not to take any business away from you guys, but I think it would sort of elevate the level of discussion in terms of having more end investors really truly understanding the risk, underwriting, and being able, you know, adding to the voice of end investors in terms of what they're looking for, the areas that concern them, and sort of, you know, the daily nitty gritty details that we care about when we trade directly in the market. And another item which hasn't been touched on, perhaps we'll later in the day, is transparency. And I think, you know, transparency is key. It's very, very hard to enhance it, as many of the folks in this audience might had discussions with me. I've been trying to push for more transparency and you know, at the end of the day, you know, you've got end investor capital, pension fund capital that is supporting reinsurance contracts. I need more transparency on those contracts, the cedents involved, the programs involved, the layers, such that I can look across the whole portfolio, across all products, and figure out, you know, get a better view of aggregation of risk, which I'm not getting out of a CAT model, a risk model. Okay. So more qualitative transparency or insight into the business.
In the micro, are you seeing investors now starting to switch appetite from more liquid to less liquid opportunities, or are still?
Unfortunately not. Okay. It's difficult to raise interest for funds that allocate to private transactions. It's much easier to raise interest for pure capital strategies. And maybe it's a bit short-sighted by investors, because they, of course, now look at the past years, not just 2023, because in 2023, clearly, our strategies that allocate to illiquid positions by far exceeded the returns for capital-only funds. But if you look back 5-10 years and just look at average returns, you know, the strategies that allocate, as we talked about, more to frequency, lower attaching deals, of course, went through a bit of a difficult cycle. And so we now see, and it's maybe a bit of a trend, we see institutional investors allocating to pure cap on strategies, even regulated UCITS funds for European strategies. Investors that in the past would deem such a product to be a retail product, and we're institutional investors, we don't do retail products. And that attitude has clearly seen a change. And we see institutional investors moving into pure cap on strategies, of course, because of liquidity.
Even though I always question how much liquidity there's actually there.
Yeah, actually, that is a very good point, right? I mean, I recently met with a consultant, and I was really surprised by his comment. He basically told me, Lorenzo, even if the funds have quarterly liquidity because you invest in a mix of private placement and cap bonds, in reality, we need to look at this now as an illiquid asset class. Because if there is a big event that causes difficult to value positions, so you end up with a side pocket, then the side pocket could last, well, he said 5 to 10 years, that is a bit harsh, but, you know, so that, even if that is a very small percentage of the overall allocation, then it means that the asset class is illiquid. And that obviously, you know, brought me back to the structuring features of the cat bonds versus the private placements. And of course, a cat bond, if there is an event, then you could have an extension mechanism, which basically extend the maturity of the bond for an additional 3 years. And probably the price of the bond is very depressed, trades at 5 if you're lucky. And where else in the private placement, maybe you don't value so drastically the asset, but you try to do your best to recover the money until the very last minute. So we could argue that you could also exit from a private placement if you either take a full loss or offer a very low price for it, right? So I think it's just a perception of the two markets. So there is also an element of making sure that we do maybe a better job when the investor look at our asset class to explain the dynamics of what happens past event, which in the past we were all worried about, right? I mean, we different managers have different attitudes. But maybe, you know, Michael, what is your view on, you know, the difference between the two assets and how would you treat you know, both, well, carbons we know is independent valuation, but how would you look at the private placement side just to give more comfort to investors and tell them, guys, there is an end to it. It's not something that goes on forever.
Well, I would still argue that a cap bond is a liquid asset and it's tradable at any given point in time. You may not like the price, you may not like the spread, but you can sell it. Even during the development period, there will be a price to it. So if you want to, just walk away. There is a price to it, and it's easier. Of course, there's always also a price to a private deal. You can always negotiate an exit on a private deal and leave some money on the table, and it's the same mechanism. But on the cap bond side, it's just much easier. And there are, in fact, a couple of traders, names that only appear every 5 to 6 years. And if you know, you know, and if you get a call from these guys, then you know you have some positions that you may not want to hold on to. So there's always a price for a cap bond. Maybe on the private side, it depends a bit on how you approach the private market, clearly. That's the question. How do you structure these transactions? And there are different ways, as we all know. We on our end spend quite some time trying to get more efficient in this area simply because we're working in a more conservative space where risk and return has seen a lot of sort of pressure over the years. And so taking enabling a more efficient solution, making sure that we don't pay too much for the structure in between, maybe making sure our investors are not allocating part of the return to just cost for the structures. We spend quite some time on that, and I think the key solution, and I probably Evelyn will confirm that, is of course running a reinsurance entity within your profit center that allows for to do structuring in-house and to allow to engage into the deal directly with the clear benefit of you don't have to post any excess collateral. So if you have a deal in development, well, you have a reserve. Of course, you follow the reserving of the counterparty once you trust the reserving of the counterparty. And there is no excess collateral blocked in any way. So you can roll and reallocate all the money that you have. And yes, if there is adverse development, of course, you still suffer. I mean, no one is safe from adverse loss development, but I think Hurricane Ian showed that it can also go the other direction. But I think having the structure in place to enable these private transactions, control the entire value chain of the direct transaction is key, to then also allow for an exit. We've negotiated exits now on certain deals from previous years, 20, 21, 22, very efficiently at very comfortable terms.
Actually, you made a very good point on being exposed to adverse development, because when you think, you know, as a sector, at the very beginning, we all tried very hard to give comfort to investors that none of the events that occurred before they invested could have affected them, right? But then we've seen that is almost impossible, right? And then if we think about the equity market, in the equity market, you invest in the stock, and then the fluctuation of the value of the stock pretty much depends on what, you know, the investors hear during a quarterly call about the reserves and whether the insurance company is going to increase reserves or decrease the reserves, so good news or bad news. So why wouldn't it be the same for our asset class, right? So that's probably something again to bring up and say, guys, you know, we cannot be perfect. I mean, this is a world of unknown unknown and known unknown, and we only discover things by experience, similar to all the other markets, right? It's not just us. Now, conscious of time, we only have 10 minutes left, so if there are any questions from the audience, then I'm sure our panelists will be very pleased to address them. Do we have a microphone for the gentleman for the end of the room there? Thank you.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jeff Reinhardt from Augment Risk. How do you guys view an ILS product that's more frequency driven versus severity driven, like a casualty ILS product that might be a bit longer tail?
Maybe I'll start. I mean, the longer tail has always been a big headache, right, for our industry. I mean, when we started looking at, I remember like a deal that we all tried to structure in the old days, which was for AXA on a casualty book, and in the end we managed to get a cat bond out there, but the reason was that AXA was very comfortable about taking the tail back after a number of years, simply because they had a very good handle of their budgeted versus actual loss ratio. and because they also knew how to talk to the regulator in terms of getting capital efficiency driven by Solvency II. However, is you know when, and I know there are you know products out there. You know my worry is always to underestimate the IRR, given that at a certain point in time you probably need a third party to provide evaluation, to provide the commute, and we know that the valuation could be painful. So that's, but you know, obviously, as far as, I always think that as far as we try to be as transparent as possible and explain carefully to the investor exactly what it means and how it works and work together with the sponsor so that we are all aligned, then of course, you know, we can execute those deals without any issues. But you know, transparency and making sure that everyone understands what it means, it's absolutely key. But please, I'm sure our panelists have their own views. Bernard, do you have any?
We haven't looked much at the casualty market, but you know, the long tail nature of that product is definitely an issue. I would also say sort of the, you know, going back to fundamentals, modeling the risk and understanding the risk is also an issue. So I think it would come down to portfolio construction, et cetera. And, but yeah, you know, I think there are definitely some complications with that product from our point of view.
Michael, do you have any view? Or
I always have a view, you know me. Yeah. We have a very distinct view, in fact. At LGT, we fundamentally believe that the reinsurance world and the reinsurance industry, and especially reinsurance carriers, capitalized reinsurance carriers, that system works. It worked for the last 150 years. So there needs to be a reason for ILS capital to flow into the space. And the reason, in our view, we're very, very simple there. The reason is because for certain massive peak exposures under the solvency regime, reinsurance companies are maxed out and they simply don't want to take that risk anymore. It's not attractive for Swiss Re to write more Florida risk because they have fully allocated everything. Maybe they can hedge it out, that's why they issue cat bonds, but they are at the level of risk they want to accept. And if there's another Florida carrier that is looking for Florida exposure, I call up Swiss Re. It might be a matter of price at one point, but at one point it's not a matter of price anymore. It's simply, this is it. Yeah. This is how much we are willing to lose for a Cat 4 hurricane that hits Miami. And then there's the question of who's taking the rest. And this is where the capital market is the most efficient solution, because we have large pension plans that can use this allocation as a diversifier. It's an event-driven, clear-cut transaction. There's a big event, you pay. There's no event, you don't pay. We all walk away. For everything that comes with the tail, with, to Bernard's point, challenges around assessment, modeling, and to your point, with the tail element and the development element, I don't think the ILS market should even become active in this space. I just blurted out here, I don't think that's something that ILS should be doing. There are many, many well-run reinsurance companies on the planet that are really specialized in taking exactly that risk. They know what they do, and they have the time to it. They can sit on it for 25 years. It doesn't matter. Their equity will never go away. Sorry, that was very loud and clear statement.
I think that's, I echo that point. I think it's a very good point you're making about the fact that the purpose of the ILS market should be complementary to the traditional market and remain complementary. And we have to be careful of not deviating from that, because then we might get in trouble. And that applies to certain emerging risks, like cyber, again. There has to be a clear motivation for the risk being transferred to capital markets.
For me, there is always a role. It's down to transparency. I mean, making sure that they really understand what we're doing. So that's...
at least the cyber risk is a systemic risk.
Yeah.
So that's maybe different from...
I agree.
Casualty or long tail.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Microphone, please. Thank you.
So you guys have all mentioned cyber risk a few times, and I think we've seen a few bonds done recently. Could you speak a little bit to the investor acceptance and buy-in to the cyber modeling and really the quantifiability and the lack of correlation and kind of how is that journey coming along? Because it seems like things are happening now.
I can start off if you don't mind.
I think we're
in the early stages of that process, right? So we've seen the market seen four 144A cat bonds being issued. There is a pretty wide margin on those transactions for the reason that you're mentioning, right? So there is some uncertainty on modeling, and that's why you're getting that extra spread. I think that will come down as investors get educated on the asset class, and I think there more and more investors will continue to participate. Right? There's a good subset of investors that are bought into that market now, and more that it's just a matter of them educating their end investors, and that process is ongoing. I think so by the end of the year, I think you'd see a lot more investors in that space than there are today, and that'll continue to grow.
I think it's early days. I think it's more of an experimental kind of product right now, and we definitely, I think, from my point of view, we want to educate ourselves on the risk, but at the same time, I want to see the insurance and reinsurance industry show me that they can deal with a large event and they can manage that risk too. Because I don't think it should be transferred to investors if the traditional market can't handle it. That's not the purpose of ILS.
We are in the same camp of learning about it.
We just don't allocate to it. So that's... easy answer for the same reasons. I think, well, at least I don't fully understand it, first of all, which I think is by far the most important reason. And secondly, I also question whether you would do cyber in bond format to really sit on the other side of the risk where there's so much, there's an information asymmetry where I would not be comfortable with.
Because that opens up a good discussion in the afternoon for the cyber session. On our end, this is currently outside of our business mandate, so that's the simple answer.
Yeah.
The sort of slightly longer answer is also maybe, I don't want to cite you, but you've mentioned that it's a systematic risk. We can see that cyber as an exposure and as a risk could have a similar level of sort of impact on the balance sheets of the large reinsurance companies to then ultimately justify a capital markets transaction. So there I'm fundamentally positive towards the topic, not so much frequency covers and long tail covers, but this is a true, it could be a global crisis, global catastrophe. Do we have enough capital to support that? The only challenge that I see right now is the fact that our investors are looking for an uncorrelated allocation that should help them to survive extreme stresses in financial markets. And arguably a large cat cyber event could mean we have a strong impact in financial markets as well. But then again, you can take the same argument for earthquakes in California. We'll likely also have an impact on stock prices.
Yeah, the comment about diversification, it's a key one for us as well in terms of, you have a macro shock and then suddenly you have a loss on cyber and when property cash should not be affected. So that could be a bad surprise for investors. Now, I'm not sure, Steve, whether we have more time for an additional question or if there is an additional question.
Good question.
But I think we're okay. There is maybe one last question there. Yeah. Okay. Because you have 18 seconds. 15.
All right. I have a similar question to the first one: frequency versus severity. I'm Hong Guo from Arbol. We're a parametric specialist. So capital market does a good job in providing additional capital for large events. I was wondering what your thoughts are for the frequency events where there's still a big gap for the cedents. Is this a good strategy for the investors to allocate? Thank you.
Bernard, you want to cover this?
I'm always a little bit confused by this dichotomy between frequency and severity because I look at sort of the holistic risk profile, the risk that we're taking on. I would say at the end of the day, there's no bad risk, but only mispriced risk. So you have to, if you can price that frequency risk well and really get paid for it, it's a good starting point. I'm looking at it from a different perspective.
Yeah, I think already within property cat, we are looking at the difference between frequency and severity, right? I mean, there's been a lot of focus from ILS managers since 17 and 18 on climate change and how we mitigate the impact of climate change. And the obvious outcome for all of us has been, okay, we need to make sure that more risk is retained, as Evelyn mentioned earlier. At the same time, we need to make sure that we try to shy away, if possible, from secondary perils, because when you look at the cumulative losses caused by secondary perils over the last 20 years have been higher by probably estimate is 200 to 300 billion than the cumulative losses caused by the primary perils, the peak perils. So, frequency also in property cat has been on our radar in terms of, also because secondary perils are more difficult to model and price, which again goes back to Bernard's point in terms of are you compensated enough or not.
Maybe one additional comment to that. First of all, I think I've noticed over the last 24 months that the industry was trying to change to using the word frequency instead of aggregate, because aggregate seems to be a bad word now, so we're talking frequency calls. But if you look at an insurance company has to meet regulatory capital requirements. And regulatory capital requirements stipulate that you have to survive a certain return period of losses. And so what you do is you cut out extreme events, which means that you're left with and currently much larger retention level, because all the markets have started to shy away from low attaching covers. So you end up with a large block of losses, mid-sized losses, that you have to retain as part of your own balance sheet protection. And your balance sheet only has a certain strength to it, and at one point there will be not enough money left. And we know that certain companies have bled out with frequency type of events. And so I can see that from a regulatory point of view, as an insurance company, you want to buy the cover, or you have to buy the cover, and you have to pay the price, to Bernhard's point. The challenge for us now as an ILS manager is very simple. An insurance company has a much better understanding about their average loss burden, their expected loss, and if I say expected loss, I mean what is our average cat loss that we're running in any given year based on our portfolio. And so then they say, well, we're losing, making up numbers here, we lose $500 million every year from these mid-sized events. Let's buy a cover at 550. Is that enough of a gap for me to have, okay, to say, okay, this is really, it's becoming a bad year? Does it have to be 600, 800, 900? Some companies have been extremely good in ultimately almost exploiting the market with their advanced knowledge about their underlying portfolio strategy, where they see growth, where they see accumulation, mini accumulations within their portfolio. So where do you set that level? And it's extremely hard to capture that. So my view there is very simple, and probably also, again, back to Bernhard's point, then I would rather participate in a quota share agreement, fairly sharing losses and returns for the entire portfolio, and use that to cut down your frequency sort of type of event. So my answer would be, we on our end clearly have no interest in growing our frequency allocation. And I'm not saying we don't do aggregate cat bonds, because we can also have cat frequency, and that's fine, that's perfectly fine, but not the low-level frequency. We've, I have to admit, burnt our fingers, and we don't want to go back there.
Okay, thank you very much.